From the fragmented world of our everyday lives, we gather together again in search of wholeness. By many cares and preoccupations, by diverse and sometimes selfish aims, we are separated from one another and even divided within ourselves. Yet we know that no branch is utterly severed from the tree of life which sustains us all. Words from our Commission on Common Worship. I'm going to ask for a volunteer to light our chalice, and would anyone like to light the chalice today? Carol, please. It's a little bit loose, this being a long weekend, and Carol, as Carol Feldhusen lights our chalice, I invite you to join in the unison words of chalice lighting printed in your order of service. We light this flame as a beacon to guide us to the world we seek, a world where love replaces hate, a world where wars cease and peace is possible, a world that is united as one global community. And I'd like to invite Katie Weeks and Laura Cataldo Holmes to join me here in the pulpit for our UU principles. The seven Unitarian Universalist principles are the values that we share as a congregation. They give us our identity and draw us together. When we say we affirm these principles, we're saying that we give them our stamp of approval. We're saying that we try to live by them and to help others to accept them and also live by them. Today, Katie and Laura will introduce one of the principles and tell us what it means to them.
This fall, we're focusing on the seven UU principles. Today we celebrate the sixth principle. We affirm and promote the goal of world community and peace, liberty, and justice for all.
Another way to say this principle is we believe in working for a peaceful, fair, and free world.
I continue to learn from the seven principles. Recently, I've been working with the issues of fairness and justice that are in this principle. I used to think fairness was people treating each other equally. Well, I still think that, but I'm now thinking that includes something a lot bigger. Right now, the best way I can say it is generosity. I can't just judge people from what's on the surface. There may be forces that I don't see that have an impact on them. For example, I learned during the recent recession that about 40% of personal bankruptcies weren't from overspending, but because somebody in the family got really sick and all the money had to go to medical care. I can really relate to that because Dave and I were lucky. We have health care, and Dave was cured of his lymphoma. So if I can sympathize with this situation, what kinds of other situations do I not even comprehend? So I'm beginning to look at my dealings with others through a lens of not just fairness, but something I'm currently calling generous fairness. I hope this attitude will help me better build a world community.
To me, this principle means that we all have to work together to make the world a better place. For the past 2 years, I've contributed to a project run by Bob and Vicky Tabor that lets families put together friendship kits which are brought to India where they are given to children in orphanages. When people send the friendship kits to the children in India, they send a picture of themselves to show who sent the friendship kit. This is a picture of Tammy Sylvie down here.
Right here.
She received the friendship kit that I sent. I find this picture very special.
In the days ahead, we ask you to be conscious of this UU principle and to think about what it means in your life.
Please join us now in saying the words of the sixth principle as printed in your order of service.
We affirm and promote the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all.
Since the start of this church year, we have been focusing on one of our Unitarian Universalist principles each week. Now, you may have noticed that the first several focus on the individual. We examined ideas such as individual worth, individual dignity, individual right of conscience, even individual truth. It's not surprising that we start with the individual because as a movement that has such strong roots in the Enlightenment, we have always celebrated individual freedom and individual growth. But you may notice that the things we say, that we promote and affirm, take a broader perspective as we get to the end of the list. Some in our movement suggest that we should start with this broader, and they would say more important, perspective of the sixth and seventh principle. That is the collective peace, the collective good, rather than the focus on just the one individual. And perhaps that might be better. But I am not as concerned about where we start than that we recognize that these goals, values, and responsibilities that we affirm, whether they are at a global level or an individual level, are inherently connected, and perhaps nowhere more so than in what our sixth principle calls us to do. How we as a nation act arises from what is in the hearts and minds of our leaders, and yes, of each citizen. As Lao Tse reminded us, if there's to be peace in the world, there must be peace in your heart. The point is that the character of our society and our world is tied to the individual character. It's tied to individual virtue. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all is a pretty lofty goal. In a world of so many wars and terrorist attacks, the idea of a world community at peace may seem pretty far-fetched. Perhaps you've resigned yourself to the idea that there will always be war. And in many ways, history would support you in that view. But throughout history, there has always been another voice, the voice of religion, the voice of the philosophers, the voice that has taught time and again that peace is possible. It's the voice that says we are called to teach that lesson. In our own tradition, the universalist Olympia Brown, the first woman that we ordained as a minister in 1850, put it this way: we can never make the world safe by fighting. Every nation must learn that the people of all nations are the children of God and must share the wealth of the world. You may say this is impractical, far away, never can be accomplished, but it is the work we are appointed to do. Sometime, somehow, somewhere, we must ever teach this great lesson. That message is based in the teachings of ancient scripture and has been preached by the prophets of our own time, from Gandhi to Martin Luther King Jr. And they all tell us that peace is possible and that the responsibility for peace does not rest on someone else's shoulders, but rests on our own. Every Thursday night, since the beginning of the war in Iraq, a group from our church and some from the greater community stand out in front of our church with signs calling for an end to war. Some would call them foolish liberals wasting their time. What could a few people with signs possibly do to make peace in the world more likely? A cynic would say nothing. But an optimist would say possibly a great deal. As people of this liberal faith, we are called to hold on to this hope that peace is possible, and that what each of us do, how we each live our lives, matters to that end. It seems to me that war always represents the failure of nations and individuals to do what is necessary to sustain a climate of peace. Instead of asking ourselves if a situation in the world calls for a war, let's ask ourselves what it is that we are doing to promote peace in that situation. Every one of us can and must do something. Those who do just little things to create a climate of peace and goodwill do more than they may know to advance peace. Often they cause others to think and reassess their all too easy acquiescence to hate or to war, Those others may be political leaders, or they may be the folks who are driving down 117 past our church on Thursday evening when they're out there with those signs. By ways of promoting peace, they need not be as direct as a vigil with anti-war signs. I'm sure you have thought about what the world would be like if, say, we were spending even one-tenth of the money we're spending on war to feed, to provide medical care, to educate the poor in those lands of conflict. I wonder, would they still want to be at war with us with that same intensity? I don't think so. The kind and level of engagement we have with others, both in our nation's life and in our personal life, determine whether we are on a course of peace and positive relationship on the more personal level, or war and isolation. I'm glad to see our foreign policy, at least in some areas, is moving away from this idea that we should not even engage in a dialogue with those who are a threat to us, and that others always must make the first move to show that they have changed before we could even consider talking with them. To me, dialogue, no matter how uncomfortable, needs to always be open, and especially with those who pose a dangerous threat to you. The more human contact, the less the possibility of war. We can't wait for others to capitulate to get peace. We are called to constantly work to build peace. Putting people in fear, waging war with people, will never lead us to peace. Instead, we have to lead with peace to expect peace. We have to live our lives and run our governments in ways that actually show that peace is our goal. This peace of which I speak is not just the absence of war. The martyred Salvadoran Bishop Oscar Romero described peace this way. Peace is not the product of terror or fear. Peace is not the silence of cemeteries. Peace is not the silent result of violent repression. Peace is the generous, tranquil contribution of all to the good of all. I repeat it. Peace is the generous, tranquil contribution of all to the good of all. And he goes on, peace is dynamism. Peace is generosity. It's right and it's duty. Peace is a dynamic force of its own, and it can be expressed in many ways. Each of us has to contribute to make peace possible. I sometimes become discouraged, almost ready to believe that war is and always will be the way of the world. But then I witness some subtle little act of extending an olive branch. And again, I realize that, yes, peace is possible. It might be between two members of in a family feud or family division. It could be much bigger than that. This week, the Nobel Prize was awarded to a group which is now working in Syria to remove and destroy all chemical weapons. And they've been working on those projects for the elimination of those horrible weapons for decades. This month, the president of Iran spoke for the first time in decades to the president of the United States. And there were indications of a willingness to talk about the nuclear buildup in that country. But on the other side of the equation, this week we also learned that it appears North Korea is back producing material for a nuclear bomb. We've been imposing sanctions and isolation since the end of the Korean War in 1953, and it has certainly not brought us closer to peace. Yes, we've given some food aid in exchange for specific concessions, but it does not seem to me that we have done things that share the desire for peace that is in our hearts in a way that connects to the desire for peace that I'm sure must be in the hearts of most North Koreans. A couple years ago, the New York Philharmonic played in North Korea, and it was broadcast to all the people of North Korea. And on that program, they played the American National Anthem, the North Korean National Anthem, and the Dvorak New World Symphony. Think about the message of those three pieces on the same program. This was not a high-level negotiation session that formally changed in any way our relationship to North Korea. But it was a powerful statement. Before leaving for Korea, the conductor of the Philharmonic was interviewed, and he made clear that they were not going to discuss politics, but instead they hoped to foster a connection and an understanding between some North Korean people and some American people. Bridges to peace began in little ways like this. I wish we could do more of this, even in the midst of saber-rattling. Now, I'm no Pollyanna that believes bringing a few artists to North Korea is going to result in peace. But even if it just softens a few hearts, opens a few eyes, connects a few North Koreans to a few Americans, it's worthwhile. Peace is built slowly, with small bits of interaction between people who are fearful of each other. If we put just a fraction of the time and energy and money that we spend waging war into waging peace, what a different world this could be. If we accept and act upon that religious teaching that peace in the world starts with peace in our hearts, there's a possibility that things could be different. I think we need to daily ask ourselves some questions. What have I done to promote peace in the world? What have I taught my children about peace? How have I reached out with a message of peace to someone with whom I may now or have been at war, in conflict? Have I tried to educate myself about difference? Have I spoken up when I heard hate expressed against an individual's race or nation or religion? Have I lived my life in a way that promotes peace within myself so that I have peace to share with the world? I believe in my heart that ordinary people all over the world don't want war and do yearn for peace. And if that's true, peace on earth is possible. But the lessons of history teach us that that yearning can be repressed by selfish ambition, by hatred, by fear, by ignorance. We cannot let this basic yearning for peace remain hidden and overpowered by those forces. We have to wage peace as strongly as we now wage war. We have to find our peace, and we have to actively and dynamically and regularly do those things that tell the world we are a people who want peace. Each of us must make a contribution of peace to the world. We'll each do it differently. Some will hold a sign at a vigil or write a letter to a political leader. Some will feed a child or build a school in an impoverished country. Some will reach out to those of different faiths and cultures within our own community with an affirming message. Some will play the violin in North Korea. Some will teach a child that the world does not have to be at war, and they can bring a message of peace to others. I want to close with words from a past president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, who was also my senior advisor at Harvard, John Burens. Reflecting on this particular principle, John told a story. Several years ago, I was in India, he wrote, in the very village where Gandhi once had his ashram. I was at a meeting of the leaders of nearly 24 social change programs, mostly aimed at the empowerment of women, especially among the poorest of the poor. At the close of the evening, the group began to sing what they called struggle songs. One song was in English, then in Hindu, then in Tamil, then in Bengali, then in Punjabi, then in Maharashtri, and other languages that were represented there. The song was, "We Shall Overcome." At first, I didn't know why I felt so overcome, why tears were streaking down my cheeks. Perhaps it was because I knew the song's origin. The tune came from Africa. It became a hymn among the Gula people of the Georgia Sea Islands who still speak an African dialect. The words then said, "I shall overcome." From there, it was taken by a Unitarian Universalist named Guy Carawan to a conference in East Tennessee. One night, he and Zelfia Horton penned the words that made the song say, "We shall overcome." What I was hearing, John writes, was a yearning for kinship, carried years ago by slaves from one continent to another, lifted up by people I knew, now being carried into the struggles of poor women half a world away and into their own dialects. Suddenly the whole concept of world community became more than a goal for me. It became something real, not merely a possibility, but an overwhelming imperative. And so it must be for us too. The goal of world community, the goal of world peace, which, as Scripture puts it, where the lion lies down with the lamb, and where people beat their spears into plowshares to till the soil rather than kill their neighbor. These should be our overwhelming imperatives. It's built one connection at a time. A small piece is added each time we reach out with love, each time we accept difference as beautiful and not fearful, each time we teach a child peace, each time we in some way are a witness for peace, as far away as it sometimes seems. In the words of that hymn we're talking about, it's been sung for generations by those who would not give up hope. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome someday. Thank you.